situations, if you like that kind of thing, we can do that. And once I do that, then you'll see it's very obvious that these days are connected, but you still just won't know why. Okay, let's take a different set of days. It's interesting because there's actually a difference of opinion when the world is created. One opinion is that the world is created in Nisan, and one is that it's created in Tishrei. And there's tension between them, because Nisan, which is in the spring, that's the month when Passover is, Nisan is the first month. Matter of fact, the Torah tells us in the beginning of the 12th chapter of Exodus, of Shmos, it says, God said to Moshe and Aaron, land of Egypt, saying, this month should be the first month for you. First month for you for the month of the year. So Rosh Hashanah is in the fall, but the first month is in the spring, and that's something which is definitely confusing, which is apparently the years begin in the fall while the months begin in the spring. By the way, it shouldn't be overly confusing because we all can or should learn to live with multiple calendars, and we do. I mean, that doesn't concern us. I mean, you're all used to the fact that the school year begins at a certain point in time. It's the beginning of the year. So therefore, if you're in the context, having a conversation in the context of school, and you say next year, then you're talking about the next school year. If you were involved in taxes and you say next year, then you're talking about the next tax year. If you are particularly interested in baseball, then next year would be whenever the baseball season begins. Which means in our lives today, we live with multiple calendars, and that's not all that difficult. Judaism also has multiple calendars, and you don't have to go further than looking at the first Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, which tells us that we have four different calendars that work together, four different points of time, which are the beginning of different years. Now, if we continue and read the beginning of the 12th chapter of Exodus, what does it tell us? It says the first day of the month is the first day of all months, and this is the beginning of the year as far as months go. Second verse then says, which really the third verse, the next verse says, that on the 10th of this month, you should every household take an animal which will later be used for the Passover offering, for the Passover sacrifice, the Korban Pesach, and says hold on to it from the 10th to the 14th, and the 14th in the evening it will be offered, and then Passover would be celebrated on the 15th. Now, why is this fascinating? Because right then you have, I said you want something rigorous, a model which exists. Here you have a model. What does the model include? It includes the first day, includes the 10th day, it includes the 14th going to the 15th day, which is almost an exact parallel to what we have in Tishrei, although in Tishrei, I said, a priori, they look like they're completely unrelated. But now we have a parallel situation, and you do have all of these days, which means, therefore, the question that you should be asking yourselves, and don't feel bad if you never did, because as far as I can tell, nobody ever did, because I can't find anybody who wrote about it, what would be the relationship between the 10th day of Nisan and the 10th day of Tishrei? And you never thought about this because, again, in your experience, the 10th day of Nisan has no significance whatsoever because it's only mentioned in the context of the Jews leaving Egypt, where God says, on the 10th day of the month, that's when you should take the offering. And that day then disappears from the calendar, no longer to be referenced, no longer to be used, unless there is an opinion that one remnant of it may be what we call Shabbos HaGadol. The Shabbos before Passover is called Shabbos HaGadol because that year, the 10th day of the month, came out on Shabbos. If this were right now Nisan and this was the spring, we would spend a lot more time trying to understand that. But all that I wanted to show you is that you do have a parallel model, which seems to indicate that the 1st, the 10th, and the 14th or 15th are related to one another. But we don't know why that should be the case in Tishrei. So let's move back to Tishrei for a moment. Now we've spread the question a little bit more. We started by questioning why Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur should be connected. And now we've spread the question to why Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot should be connected. And again, at face value, not only is Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur not connected, but Sukkot is certainly not connected with the others. There seems to be no specific thing which would cause us to think that they are part of one concept. Now, the Vilna Gaon gave us the first piece of information, even though he wasn't the first to say this, but gave us the first piece of information to help us solve the riddle. But as all good mysteries, he didn't solve it completely for us, he just gave us the first piece of information. He raises an old question. The question is, why is Sukkot commemorated in the fall and not in the spring? The Jews left Egypt in the spring. Sukkah commemorates one of two things, according to the Talmud. Either it commemorates the fact that Jews sat in a sukkah, or it commemorates the clouds that hovered above us and protected us in the desert. So the old question is, why is Sukkot celebrated or commemorated in the fall when the Jews left Egypt in the spring? So therefore, either if it's divine protection or if it's the sukkah itself, literally the tents that they lived in, either way, this should have been commemorated in the spring. So the famous answer which is offered for this is that had we sat in tents or sukkahs in the springtime, it would have looked like we're doing this just because it's comfortable and it's pleasant. And it's nice to sit outside in the spring. And had we sat outside in the fall, then where the weather is terrible, then we're doing it specifically because God commanded us to do it. Now, that's the normal answer that if you would have grown up going to yeshiva, that's the answer they would have given you, and you would have accepted it, despite the fact that there are multiple problems with it. One problem with it, which is really the major problem, is that that's very dependent upon particular climates. Okay, you know what? Growing up in Brooklyn, New York, that was a very acceptable answer. Because in Brooklyn, New York, more often than not, then it was already getting cold by sukkahs, and it was getting windy. And I remember sitting in our sukkah as a kid with a coat on, with a sweater on, and even bringing the heater inside the sukkah because it was cold. I have a friend who grew up in Cleveland, and they've had snow on their sukkah, and that all the more so. But I also know people that grew up in California, and that answer does not make any sense if you grew up in California. But it's not just California doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in this climate either. It's very pleasant to sit outside in a sukkah, generally, in the fall in Israel. It's very pleasant to sit outside. Second point, by the way, if you really were discomforted in the sukkah, then you don't have to sit in the sukkah. A sukkah where you're not comfortable is not a sukkah, because a sukkah is a quasi-home. A home that you don't feel comfortable living in is not a home. So therefore, there's almost an internal contradiction to that answer, because it doesn't work within the laws of sukkah. So as I said, there are multiple problems with this response. Nonetheless, you know, we were kids, we all accepted it. That's what it is. So, which sometimes it's better not to have gone to yeshiva as a kid, because then you never learned these things. The Vilna Gaon gave a different answer. He said that what we commemorate by sukkah is not the clouds or the divine protection when the Jews left Egypt. He says, no. Those clouds disappeared, or dissipated, I guess if it's clouds, when the Jews sinned with the golden calf. And then the Jews were protectionless till when Moshe comes down the second time holding the tablets. The next day he starts to teach them about the laws that God told them. One of the laws he teaches them is about building the Mishkan, building the tabernacle. They collect the materials for the tabernacle for a couple of days. They stop on the third day, and then they start to build. What day is that? The 15th day of the month. The Vilna Gaon said on that day, when they started to build the Mishkan, when the Jews reached out towards God and says, let us build a home for God, and they started building it, at that moment the clouds returned. So he said that the sukkah that we build doesn't commemorate the clouds that accompany us out of Egypt. It commemorates the clouds of forgiveness, the clouds of healing the relationship between God and the Jewish people. By the way, once you understand that, as I said, that's as far as he goes. Once you understand that, now working backwards and connecting that with Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur shouldn't be all that hard, but, you know, let's try to make it as complicated as possible. That's why they pay me. When we look at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and again, at face value, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are not connected at all in terms of what they commemorate. Again, Rosh Hashanah should commemorate creation of the world or creation of man, or even the day that man was judged. Yom Kippur should commemorate the day the Jews were forgiven with the golden calf. Face value, no relationship. But that's in terms of the analysis which I did, which would be a quasi-historical archaeology, again, trying to dig beneath the surface to find out what these days are about in terms of their historical identity. But there's another way of doing the analysis, and that would be based upon the customs or the laws or the rituals involved in those days. So let's go to Rosh Hashanah for a moment. Rosh Hashanah, we are given very little information about in the Torah. The Torah gives us virtually no explanation, no rhyme or reason for what this day is. All that it says about it is one word. And what is that? It calls it a day of Truah, which you wouldn't even know what it means, blowing. When I say even the word Truah, we don't even know what it means. You have to look at other verses to figure out what the word means. Only based upon analyzing the word Truah and looking at it in other contexts, then you can figure out the operational definition of the word Truah, and then come to the understanding that, in fact, we're talking about blowing the shofar, which is now wonderful, except we have no idea why we're blowing the shofar and what the significance of blowing the shofar is, which means simply based on an analysis of the biblical text, both locally and comparing it within its larger scope, you will not know what Rosh Hashanah is about other than that you blow the shofar. Now, when we want to try to understand what the meaning of something is, one way to do it is what I've already just now done. Again, you analyze its meaning. Another way is you analyze the context. Another way you analyze other times the word is used. One significant aspect or element in trying to decipher what things mean or what things are about is to try to find the first time that something is mentioned in the Torah. And by the way, that's not always as easy as you think. Because to look at something the first time doesn't mean the first time it's hinted at, the first time it says it. Which means, where's the first time you find the shofar being used in the Torah? I'd say where it's the first time it's hinted at, the first time maybe I can find the reference. The first time the word shofar is used. Okay, I'll answer the question. Correct. The first time is with the giving of the Torah. When the Torah is given as a preparation, it says not to go up the mountain the whole time that the first it uses the word Yovel, the Yovels, and then it goes on to say, but that the shofar blew, and we have the blowing of the shofar connected with the giving of the Torah. Okay? Let's pause there for a second. The other thing that we have, if you look at the verses which describe the giving of the Torah, there's another element to it, and that is the appearance of the clouds. The Torah is given with the mountain having a cloud hovering above it, while the sound of the shofar. So I have two elements there. One element is the shofar, another element is the cloud. Now, before you think of clouds and run right back to Sukkos, there's another major place that clouds are used, or even better, where clouds are actively used or actively utilized. And what's that? That's in discussion. Correct. That's what I just now said. At Sinai, the clouds make an appearance. I'll say again what I asked. Where do you find that a cloud is actively utilized by man? Which is a little bit more intriguing. And you're not going to guess this unless you know the answer to it. So don't bother trying to guess. When we find the verses which instruct us or instruct the Kohen Gadol to go in and to do the work on Yom Kippur, what does it say that he needs to do? It says that he needs to make a cloud of smoke with something called the Ketores, but the word Anan is used, and it says only by use of the Anan, using this cloud, can he enter into the place of where it's holy. Well, maybe I'll rephrase that, because I wasn't being precise. When he goes into where it's holy, that's what he does, is he causes the cloud to come out, which means that's what the Kohen Gadol does in the Holy of Holies. He goes in with a fistful, you bend down the three middle fingers, and you take this much of the incense, this is how you fill it up in your hand, and then you walk inside holding it, which is, if you try this position for a little bit, it's not that easy, you can try it, right? And he'll grab it and he'll hold it and he'll go inside. He's going to be holding in like a shovel, he'll be holding it. Then he has the coals, and then he mixes the incense with the coals, and he causes the whole room to get filled up with smoke. Okay, that's what the Kohen Gadol does when he goes inside. But again, what's significant to us is the use of the word Anan. He's going in to create an Anan. Look, it's also quite significant that he's creating a Ketores. What is a Ketores? It's incense. Why would that be significant? Because this can take us right back to Adam, by the way. If we do this, then you'll be very happy because you'll have at least part of your connection between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. When man sinned by the tree of knowledge of good and evil, if you read the verses carefully, you'll find that virtually every sense is corrupted during that sin. Listening to the advice of the serpent, seeing the tree, touching the tree, eating from the tree. There's only one sense that was not corrupted during the sin. What was that? The sense of smell. So therefore, there's a Kabbalistic teaching. It's found in a book called the Bnei Yisachar. There's a Kabbalistic teaching that the healing of Yom Kippur will specifically be done with the one place which was never corrupted, and that's the sense of smell. So therefore, you go into the Holy of Holies, you're trying to fix the sin, or all sin, but the core of sin doesn't include the sense of smell. But by the way, the reason why this is even more complicated is the way that incense works. I don't know how many of you have ever tried to make incense or try to make perfume, but the way that they would make it is, if you read the ingredients, generally what they would take, you need an accelerator. You need something which will deliver the payload. Let me explain this in simpler English. You would generally take something which is very bad smelling and a very, very strong smell, very pungent, and then you, because that delivers the smell, and then you'll cover that up with something which was sweet. That's how perfumes or incense are. Today everything's artificial. We live in an artificial world. There's nothing real anymore. But I'll give you an example. Theoretically, if you could, let's say, capture the smell of a skunk, that's a terrible smell. But if you can capture that smell and then learn how to cover up the bad parts of the smell, you would have an unbelievable, powerful perfume that can fill up entire spaces, because such a bad smell can fill up a large area in a very short amount of time. So what they would do when they would make the incense is they would use something bad and cover it up with something good. That's an incredible metaphor. You understand what I'm saying? It means that, again, intrinsically, what is the incense? It's taking something bad and covering it up with something good. And what happens when bad and good mix? Again, what happens by the eating of the tree of knowledge and good and evil? What was the problem? Knowledge is good, right? No, not a tree which is a knowledge of good and evil. Now you have a mixture. A mixture of good and evil causes incredible confusion. What is good and what is evil? But part of the fixing of that is again creating a mixture. And in this new mixture, you're going to take the evil and you're going to cover it up with something good. And now what do you have as the sum total? Only good. Which means that's how tshuva works. Tshuva works by taking what's bad and covering it up with a good smell, which means all those bad things that I could have done, now when it comes down to it, is good. Okay, let's go on a little bit. That's good. You writing that down? That's good. But you don't get to have dinner Friday night, so you can't even repeat it. Motzi Shabbos. I guess you can Friday afternoon during the Suda. Be busy eating. Okay. So, let's now think again. When the Torah was given, something went wrong. What went wrong? Right afterwards, we get the hint. It says all the people hear or see the sound of God, including the sound of the shofar, and they move away. They recoil from God. Moshe says, and they then say to Moshe, you give us the Torah, because when God speaks to us, you know, we can die. So Moshe says, no. Accept the Torah from God, because then the fear of God will be on you and you won't be able to sin. And the people move away. What happens? They didn't take the Torah directly from God. What happened? They sinned. How do they sin? With the golden calf. What was the cause of the sin of the golden calf? Moving away from God. That's what causes the sin. Which, by the way, now you know that part of the healing process will need to be to try to move close to God. That's going to have to be part of the healing, because they move away. That means that the giving of the Torah, something went wrong. What were the elements by the giving of the Torah? The sound of the shofar prepared them. By the way, Moshe had the sense they weren't ready. How do we know this? Because God said to prepare for 2 days, and Moshe adds another day. What do we have as far as the preparation? The shofar is part of the preparation. What happens afterwards? Afterwards, Moshe comes down, the people are sitting with the golden calf. Again, what was the other element involved? The whole place was filled with the cloud, and the cloud symbolized the divine presence. And man wasn't ready for that. What happens now? And then when Moshe comes down, he sees the people sinning, he takes the tablets, he throws it down, he breaks it. That's also something he did on his own, and God also agrees. Which means now you realize the two things that Moshe did on his own are related to one another. Namely, adding a day and then breaking the tablets, both of them indicating ultimately that man really wasn't quite ready. Now, what happens afterwards? The people are forgiven, Moshe goes up, Moshe gets the new tablets, comes down on Yom Kippur. What do we have subsequently? We find this law now that on Rosh Hashanah you blow the shofar. Now I'll ask you, what is the symbol of the blowing of the shofar? The symbol is getting prepared to accept the Torah. Now instead of having 2 days preparation or 3 days preparation, now we have 10 days leading up to Yom Kippur. Okay? Point one. What was the other thing? The people weren't prepared to stand right in front of God. They moved away. So now what does the Kohen Gadol do? He goes into the Holy of Holies. He approaches the divine. And what does he do? Now he creates the cloud. Once that's done, and forgiveness is attained, then all the people go and build a sukkah, which commemorates the cloud which protected all of the people, specifically after they were forgiven. Now, once I did this, now you realize that the first day of the month, Rosh Hashanah, the 10th day, and Sukkot are all related, just like we had seen earlier regarding Nisan, that these are all related. Now, let's go a little bit further. There's a commentary which is known as the Meshech Chachma, Rav Meir Simcha, a Kohen from Dvinsk. In his commentary to Exodus, he notices something which is interesting. And I'll explain it a little bit more than he did. He said it in a relatively terse fashion. In the portion of Mishpatim, there is a reference to the three holidays, what's known as the Shalosh Regalim. It says, this is chapter 23, verse 14 and on. It says, Shalosh Regalim techog li bashana. Three holidays you should commemorate during the year. Es Chaga Matzos, the holiday of Matzah, Tishmor Shivas Yamim, Tocho Matzos. Sorry, I didn't read it right. Es Chaga Matzos Tishmor Shivas Yamim Tocho Matzos. You should guard the holiday of Matzos, 7 days eat Matzos, Kashetzi Visicha, as I've commanded you. Lumoid Chodesh Aviv, this should be done in the spring. Kivo Yitzasam Mitzrayim, because that's when you left Egypt. Below your Upanairi come, and when you come up to visit the temple, don't approach the temple empty-handed. Now, if you want an easy way to give a Dvar Torah, or at least to start thinking about a Dvar Torah, you could, whenever the holidays are mentioned, you can always look for one of two things. When the holidays of Judaism are mentioned, you either have an agricultural or a historical reference. Because ultimately, what the Jewish holidays do is they take the agricultural holidays and give them theological significance, which means it's not that one is true and the other isn't true. It's that Judaism creates a marriage between real life, which certainly for the farmers was agriculturally based, and history and theology. So when you take historical meaning, historical events, like leaving Pesach, leaving Egypt in the spring, and you take the spring agriculture reality and you merge them together, you end up with a theological significance of the agricultural holidays. So therefore, if you want the formula, it would be history plus agriculture equals theology. That's what takes place. Now, what's interesting over here is that the reference that it made to Passover was exclusively, or at least 99%, historical and not agricultural. It didn't speak about the agricultural behavior which is done at this time of the year. It says, no, what's the significance of the spring? What did it say? Because that's when you left Egypt. The next verse, it says, V'chag ha-katsir b'kurei ma'asecha asher tizra b'sadeh v'chag ha-asif b'tzei hashana ba'asfachad ma'asecha min ha-sadeh. the festival of the harvest of the first fruits of your labor that you sow in the field, and the festival of the ingathering at the close of the year when you gather the work of your field. Now, what's interesting is that when it came to the other two holidays, it didn't give any historical information. All that it did is it gave agricultural information. So this is an obvious problem. Why should the Torah shift from a historical to an agricultural perspective? Normally in the Torah, what you'll find is one or the other. You're not going to find the two of them mixed together in this, like in this instance. Point taken? So the Meshech Chachma says, this proves the Vilna Gaon's point. You say, what? How did this prove the Vilna Gaon's point? So he said, look where this is written in the Torah. Look at the context. This is Parshas Mishpatim. This is the 23rd chapter. This is before the Jews sinned with the golden calf. If it's before they sinned with the golden calf, he says, do you know why it doesn't refer to this as Sukkos, commemorating the Sukkah? You know why? Because there was no such thing as Sukkah at that point. When does the Vilna Gaon say the Sukkah is created? Only as a result of the cloud that returned after the Jews were forgiven, after they sinned with the golden calf. If there's no golden calf yet, then there's no forgiveness after the golden calf, and there's no clouds that return after they're forgiven for the golden calf, so there's no Sukkah. And he goes so far as to imply that had there not been a sin of the golden calf, I say imply, I'm saying all this now. He said they never want to make it easy. He goes so far as to imply, or at least we can now conclude, that had there not been a sin of the golden calf, there would not have been a holiday of Sukkos. What would there have been? There would have been a holiday, which was a holiday of the end of the year, an agricultural holiday. How would we have commemorated that agricultural holiday of gathering various fruits and vegetables? How would we have commemorated it? With the four species. Which means taking the lulav and the esrog and so on commemorates the agricultural holiday. That's the Kamarit Chag HaAsif. That has nothing to do with Sukkah. It has nothing to do with the holiday of Sukkahs. Of course, you'll tell me, but it's the same thing. Yes, today it's the same thing. But that would have been a holiday commemorating the ingathering. So what do you do when you gather? You gather the lulav, the esrog, and you gather the things. Nothing to do with the Sukkah. There never would have been a Sukkah. Which means, where does the holiday of Sukkah come from? It comes afterwards. And the Meshech Chachma says, see, the Vilna Gaon is right, because there's no reference to Sukkah at this point. The only references we have to Sukkah are after the Jews are forgiven for the golden calf. Now, that's a fascinating point. Agreed? Good. You know what else is missing from this section? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Why should Yom Kippur be missing? What is Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur commemorates the forgiveness the Jews received after they sinned to the golden calf. If this is before the golden calf, then there's no forgiveness. No forgiveness. There's no need for Yom Kippur. The other thing which is interesting is that Rosh Hashanah is missing. Now, I'm not saying that it never would have been a Rosh Hashanah. I just don't know how it would have been commemorated. I don't know what its significance would have been. It could have been. That's the day that commemorates the creation of the world, but doesn't necessarily have anything to do with us. Could have been the case. But what's interesting is now we realize that this sin, the sin of the golden calf, causes there to be all kinds of holidays and all kinds of prayers and all kinds of service to God which did not exist prior to this. That, as far as I'm concerned, is a fascinating issue. You know, there's a teaching in the Talmud that maybe we never understood. Teaching says, is how powerful is tshuva, how powerful is return to God? That when you return to God, you're able to take sin that you did, that in its context was sin, and it turns sin into something which is positive, into something which is meritorious. How's that possible? But here we see that the sin that we did with the golden calf gets reshaped, you know, almost like something which is very pungent in smell and that's covered up with something sweet. It gets reshaped, remodeled, reused, and it gets turned into Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkos. And all of them now fall in line, replacing or fixing, or doing what's called a tikkun, different elements of the sin of the golden calf. And by the time then we're finished with this month of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and of Sukkos, what do we end up having? We end up having all of this merit that we never would have had had there never been that sin in the first place. Now, I know the conclusion you can now draw from this. You can say, well, I may as well sin, because if I don't sin, listen, on one hand, I'll have nothing to do in Yom Kippur. But by the way, I'll point out that generally the prayers that we make are public, are for the masses, and not just for ourselves. It's fascinating, because even Jews that pray with a great deal of devotion don't pay attention that almost all the prayers that we say every single day of the year are in the plural. So much so, if I already started with the Vilna Gaon, I'll finish with the Vilna Gaon today, so much so that the Vilna Gaon said that if you pray every single day, but you only pray for yourself and never pray for other people, you've never prayed in your life. But I'll go further than that. It's not just praying for other people. You know, when you think about the situation of sin is really about estrangement from God. Can you imagine how a parent feels if a child is estranged from them? It feels very bad for the child, and you want to try to connect the child back with their parent. But how does the parent feel? Which means, I'm not going to say that God feels pain, because I'm not going to ascribe any kinds of emotions to God. But the disconnection between God and the people is something which we should be feeling pain about. Which means on Yom Kippur, even if you haven't sinned all year, you should still pray that there should be some kind of a healing which takes place between God and between humanity. That's something which is necessary. But just in case that a person has sinned, and again, I'm not saying that sin is good and sin is necessary, but I will say something else. That sin has a power to it, and the whole idea of Yom Kippur is to take that power and to utilize it. That's the symbol of the Ketores. That's what the Ketores tells us. Take that power of the sin and put something sweet on it. Give it a good smell afterwards. And then what do I have in totality? This is the amazing thing. What do I then have in totality? It's not that I did a sin and now I made it better. No, now in totality, what do I have? I have something which smells good. That's reality. But you'll tell me that historically, I used to have sin and now I fixed it. God doesn't work within history. God transcends history. God exists in present tense, all the time. Which means what's true right now is what's significant, and that's part of what God allows us to connect to, which is really the much deeper reason why the only way that tshuva is possible, philosophically, the only way that it's possible is when you connect to God. See, in the secular world, there's a thing which is called rehabilitation. What does rehabilitation mean? Yesterday, something was wrong, and today something is better. What's the reality then? That yesterday was something wrong, today something is better. It's not that, oh, because today's better, that it was never wrong before. Of course it was. But God exists outside of time. And when you stand in front of God, when you accept God, at that point history becomes completely irrelevant. At that moment, the only reality is the fact that you're standing in front of God. And that means that if you've been able to take that sin and use it as a power to cover it up and do something good with it, that's the reality right now. That's all that exists, is that powerful thing. Which means when we look at it today, what do we have? We have Rosh Hashanah, and we have Yom Kippur, and we have Sukkot, and we have all of these mitzvot to do, all of these positive things to do. And that's how you can understand now how God can take sin, and once you do tshuva, a sin can get turned into something which becomes a mitzvah, becomes a schus, becomes a merit. How can you do that? Don't try to figure this out logically. It's not logic, but it's not illogical either. What it is operating on a completely different level and trying to understand the world from God's perspective. And that's this incredible thing that God allows us to do. God allows us to take our mistakes and to cover them up and to repackage them and to turn them into positive energy. And when we succeed in doing that, then we can change everything. That's what it really means to stand in front of God. Because when you stand in front of God, and again, go back now, realize that was the mistake that took place by Har Sinai. The Jews weren't able to stand in front of God. They had to back out. They recoiled. They weren't able to accept it. So when man is able to stand in front of God, and that's the feeling you get on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, you'll stand, the Arad Kodesh will be open, you'll feel the presence of God, and you stand in front of God at that point, and you accept upon yourself the Torah, you accept upon yourself that you've made mistakes, and you dedicate yourself to fix those mistakes. At that moment, that becomes the only reality, and anything negative that exists gets covered up with the most delightful smell. And at that point, it becomes perfume. And at that point, all of our sins become something which is positive. God should bless us all with a Gemar Chasima Tova and give us the ability of turning all negative things into positive ones.